Hey there, and welcome to another Health Essentials podcast. I'm John Horton, your host. Imagine starting every meal, every snack, every little nibble of food, wondering if one bite might hurt or kill you. That's a daily reality for anyone living with food allergies. More than 170 different foods have been found to cause allergic reactions. It's a wide-ranging list that includes many common refrigerator or pantry items, but there are 9 foods in particular that are considered major allergens. That's what we're going to focus on today. Joining us is allergist Jacqueline Bajelic, Associate Director of the Cleveland Clinic Food Allergy Center of Excellence. Dr. Bajelic is one of the many experts at Cleveland Clinic who pop into our weekly podcast to help broaden our knowledge and understanding of health issues. So let's take a look at the big 9 of food allergens and learn a little more about the signs and risks of each. Dr. Bajelic, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
So I got to tell you, I've been really looking forward to this discussion. As we talked about earlier, I have a son with food allergies. And I know when he was born and we started looking into it, we felt so isolated because it was not something that was talked about a lot. It seems like general knowledge of that has just exploded in recent years. What's been happening with that?
John, thanks so much for sharing your perspective. I think it's a space where so many patients and families who are managing food allergy have come from. You know, unfortunately, food allergy prevalence is increasing, but thankfully, awareness surrounding this diagnosis is also increasing. And I think as providers, you know, doctors, nurses, we're doing a much better job of managing the whole patient. We're not just saying, here's your diagnosis, good luck, but we're really trying to empower families. There's a lot of literature that supports a really great multidisciplinary approach to food allergy, which is why we've been so excited to open our Food Allergy Center of Excellence at the Cleveland Clinic.
Well, and I'm so glad that we have that because I know how important it is just within my own family. So, you talked about raising awareness, and that is why we're here today, and specifically to talk about kind of the big 9 of food allergies, which I guess there's real common foods that cause these problems. But I guess before we kind of get into those specifics, can you walk us through kind of what a food allergy is and why somebody's body might just respond so aggressively to a basic food item?
Yeah, that's a great question. We could probably spend a lot of time talking about what is food allergy. You know, and I tell my families, if I knew why you have a food allergy, I'd have a Nobel. So here we are in a space where we certainly don't know everything. But what we do know is that when a patient has a food allergy, your immune system has identified a particular food protein as potentially dangerous. And when you eat that food, it creates a cascade of immune events that results in potentially serious life-threatening allergic reactions. So true food allergy is different than patients who are managing things like food intolerances or celiac disease, which are a very different process that usually have more to do with digestion than actually the immune system itself.
There's a real irony there in that your body is trying to defend itself against something that it sees as a threat. And by doing that, it actually puts you at risk.
Yeah, it's really a hard space to come from when you're trying to explain it, not just to parents, but also to young kids, trying to explain to them. It almost feels kind of like your body is turning on you. And there's unfortunately a lot of disease processes in medicine where this happens. Autoimmune diseases, you know, I mentioned celiac, it's really an autoimmune disease. Things like type 1 diabetes, something's going wrong with the checkpoints in your immune system, and it's attacking something that it's not supposed to.
What are some of the symptoms that people who have an allergic reaction show?
Yeah, so food allergy reactions are not subtle. So if a family comes to me and they're like, we're not sure if our kid has a food allergy, that actually decreases my level of suspicion quite a bit. So when we're talking about true immune food allergy, typically within minutes, sometimes up to 2 hours after eating a food, a patient can experience a spectrum of symptoms. And the severity of those symptoms can depend on a lot of factors, and we're still learning a lot about this, but how much you've eaten, if you're sick or fighting off an infection, what else are you doing at the time that you eat that particular allergen? All of these things can impact reaction severity. Food allergy reactions can impact every organ system in the body. You know, we sort of typically think about hives, and absolutely they can be present. So itchy rashes that present immediately. You can have swelling of the mouth, tongue, of course, the throat would be a particularly concerning symptom. Some of our patients can have trouble breathing. And in very severe reactions, your body actually has trouble getting blood to all of your organs. You drop your blood pressure and you can actually pass out. Thankfully, it is exceedingly rare, particularly in the United States, to have a fatal food allergy reaction. But certainly, you know, patients and parents, that's, I think, something that underlies all of our worries is, you know, could I die from this? But thankfully, that's very, very rare.
Yeah, and it is. It's very scary. And just living with it is, I know how scary it can be because you always have that fear.
Yeah, and food's so social and we're constantly exposed to food. And as kids reach independence milestones, you know, they're not eating with their parents as much. You're not always with them. It definitely is an anxiety-provoking condition for patients and families to manage.
Well, at the start, I noticed there's 170 different foods that people, I guess they've shown allergies to. But as I understand it, 90% of reactions are kind of linked to nine specific foods, the big nine. So let's break them down. Are you ready to jump into this?
Let's do it.
All right. I've got my list here. So let's start with milk.
Yeah. So milk's one of the most common food allergens in the United States, particularly in young children. It thankfully is one that is typically outgrown by adulthood, though not always. The number that we give families is about 80% of kids would outgrow milk allergy. Milk is a fickle, tricky creature because it can actually cause a lot of different types of reactions. So young infants can often have something called a milk protein intolerance, where they get lots of stomach symptoms. They're fussy, gassy babies from milk exposure, either from maternal breast milk or from a cow's milk-based formula. Most kids outgrow that, so why it can be a really challenging time, particularly when you're not sleeping in the infant period, kids will outgrow that. And while it's very bothersome, it is not dangerous. This is very different than a milk allergy. In older kids, we often have to tease out. Families will come with kids with symptoms of bloating or diarrhea after consuming select milk products. This is much more likely to be a lactose intolerance than a true milk allergy. Kids who are truly allergic to milk will have those immediate symptoms that I mentioned. Very rarely would they be isolated to one part of the body like the gut or stomach, though certainly if you're having any symptoms with food ingestion, that deserves talking to your doctor. But kids who have true milk allergy can't eat any form of milk. So not just drinking glasses of milk, but they can't have butter, cheese, yogurt, anything. And milk is in so many things. It can be extremely limiting and also very isolating. Like you can't have the cake at birthday parties and things like that. So milk is common, thankfully frequently outgrown. But very, very impactful, as all food allergy is, but milk in a particularly frustrating way.
How soon do kids usually outgrow that? Is there a certain age where if they're going to kind of overcome it, they do?
Yeah, so every kid's different. And in the allergy world, we're able to track the level of allergy antibody that your immune system is creating to a given food. So milk, for example, we can check your IgE, is the allergy antibody. We can check your level to milk year to year and track it. And as that number starts to drop, typically by grade school age, we're able to try and reintroduce milk in as safe a way as possible.
Okay. Well, it's always good to know that there's a good chance that you can outgrow it. So moving on to another one, eggs, as I understand, is a big one.
Yeah, egg is the second most common allergen, particularly in children in the United States. This is also one that most kids do outgrow. But again, while it's there, as you can imagine, with all the different products that contain egg, whether they be baked goods or, you know, grandma's lasagna, it's extremely impactful. So, you know, every food allergen is a challenge to avoid, but milk and egg can present particular challenges because they also tend to hide.
Well, it is really hard. You can't see it, like nuts or things like that. You can clearly see, but like you said, if an egg's baked into something, you don't know.
Or something with an egg wash, things like that. And our patients with egg allergy, we tell them to avoid the whole egg, yolk, and whites. Thankfully, many kids with egg allergy and milk as well are actually able to tolerate baked forms. So you can talk with your allergist about if your child might be a candidate to try baked forms of these foods. Chances are far more likely than not that the answer is yes.
That's always good to know that there's maybe a little room in there, but I take it it's on a case-by-case basis.
You bet. But just from the idea of being able to expand the diet as much as possible, it can be really powerful. Get that birthday cake in there.
My son has an egg allergy, and that is always one of the hardest things because you can't have that sort of stuff. So, moving on to, I think the one that everyone thinks of when you talk about food allergies is peanuts.
Yeah. So peanut is a very common food allergen, particularly in the United States. It's one of the allergens that's best studied because very different than milk and egg, it tends to persist lifelong. So less than 1 in 5 people would naturally outgrow a peanut allergy. Peanut's actually a legume, but it gets called a nut. Botanically, it's more closely related to peas, which many kids wouldn't be too sad to be allergic to pea. But it sort of gets lumped into that nut category. So peanut is a required label. All of the top 9 allergens now are per the FDA. So if you're eating a food processed or manufactured in the United States and it has labeled ingredients and it contains peanut, it must say so.
Which is literally a lifesaver for people. I remember, like I said, when my son was really young, like having to comb through, like reading all the fine print, because it was before they had stuff highlighted. And it does make it so much easier to have these main allergens ID'd.
Such a layer of complexity for everything from grocery shopping to just picking out a snack at a ball game. Every label, every time. That's what we tell families.
Definitely. So now you had already alluded to this, but next on the list is tree nuts, and those are different than peanuts. So what can you tell us about the tree nut allergies?
Tree nuts, in the United States, most reactions are due to cashew, pistachio, and walnut and pecan. But also many people are tested for almond, hazelnut, macadamia nut, Brazil nut, and there are others. But cashew, pistachio, walnut, pecan definitely constitute the majority of real allergens. What we've seen, especially recently, is if you test positive to almond and hazelnut, if you haven't ever eaten them before, it's actually pretty unlikely that you're truly allergic. And this sort of points out, you know, some of our limitations with diagnosing food allergy. We have no perfect test. The only perfect test is what happens when you eat it. So a lot of people come to us and they say, we were told we can't eat peanut or any tree nuts, and we're able to have them leave eating at least more than when they came in. And almond and hazelnut are a really common example of that among the tree nuts, which is always really exciting. Because if you read labels often, as some of us do, you see that things are frequently labeled just for almond or just for hazelnut, particularly in candies, baked goods. So it's really nice to be able to liberalize the diet for families, even if they do have to avoid select tree nuts.
And I'd imagine tree nuts also pose a danger because they can also be hidden in baked goods or products that are just kind of out at a party and you don't know that they're in there.
Absolutely. And as things are trying to move towards foods that are a little bit more nutritionally dense, tree nuts are being used more and more often. You know, I had a kid come in who'd had a cashew-encrusted chicken, at a local restaurant. That wasn't something that they were serving when I was growing up. So there's definitely some more exposures now. So more opportunity for kids who are allergic to react.
All right. Well, let's move into from land into water here with the next two. And one allergen would be shellfish. I understand this is like one of the more common one among all age groups, right?
Yeah. So shellfish and finfish, but shellfish in particular is a relatively rare allergen, particularly in young children, which could be exposure related. You know, I don't know too many 1 and 2 year olds who are like going for the shrimp tray at a party. But again,
they're not clamoring for that.
Oh, John, I see what you did there. That was punny. So, but it does persist into adulthood. So many of our adult patients are managing shellfish allergy as well as finfish allergy. So you're absolutely right. And those remain top 9 allergens in the United States. They're required labels. And while they tend to be, from a day-to-day standpoint, a little less challenging to avoid compared to maybe a milk or egg, can still be really impactful from a quality of life standpoint.
I thought I read somewhere, too, where even with shellfish, there's even more issues you see with that, even with the vapors, like when they're being cooked. Is that true?
Yeah. So everybody should always talk about their particular situation with their allergist, but very few food proteins like float in the air trying to attack you. With nearly all foods, you have to actually eat the food to have a reaction. So for example, little Johnny's sitting next to a friend at school. The friend is eating a peanut butter sandwich. Unless little Johnny smears some peanut into his mouth or into his eyes, no risk from just being around it. That differs from shellfish because actually while it's cooking, the vapors do aerosolize some of the allergenic proteins. And some of our patients with shellfish allergy will actually have airborne contact reactions to shellfish.
Wow. Well, that's scary.
It is
to
scary.
To be honest. It's
definitely scary for them, but I guess an excuse to not have to help in the kitchen. So stay out of there.
You know, I love how you can find a silver lining in anything there. So, and looking at the other side of it, just the finfish swimming around, are there certain ones there that are more prone to, or people are more prone to be allergic to?
Yeah, I think that mostly depends on, you know, regional differences, dietary practices. But you can react to any fin fish, any of the white fish like cod, tilapia, salmon is a relatively common one where we are in the United States. So you can react to any fin fish. And most of the fin fish have very similar allergenic proteins. So if you're allergic to one, it's very likely that you would be allergic to others.
Okay. All right. Well, now we're gonna switch back to land again.
Okay.
So we're jumping all over the place. So wheat. Tell us about wheat allergens and in particular, how it's different from gluten sensitivity and celiac disease.
Yeah. So wheat's even more of a fickle creature than milk that we've already talked about, can cause lots of adverse reactions in the body. And it's absolutely worth mentioning, we're still learning so much about how our bodies respond to foods when we eat them. But what should happen is you should be able to enjoy a bagel or a piece of bread, and nothing should happen other than you feel full. But with patients who have true wheat allergy, within a few minutes of eating the food, they would have symptoms of those allergic reactions that I mentioned, which certainly can include vomiting and diarrhea, but are usually also accompanied by some skin symptoms, plus minus some breathing symptoms. And those, again, are potentially life-threatening. There are individuals out there, kids, but often not diagnosed until adulthood, who suffer from an autoimmune disease called celiac disease, and they're not able to properly digest a particular wheat protein, and it can lead to some pretty significant gastrointestinal effects, bloating, discomfort, diarrhea, poor growth. Once diagnosed, all you have to do is not eat wheat, and those symptoms thankfully resolve. There are other individuals who we don't identify to have celiac disease, but can have a lot of gastrointestinal symptoms after they consume wheat. We tend to sort of globally call these individuals non-celiac gluten intolerance, but it's probably a disservice. There's probably multiple different things happening depending on the person that we still have yet to figure out. But again, after they eat wheat, they can be very uncomfortable, might need to rush to the bathroom to have a bowel movement. They feel much better after the bowel movement. But it can be really challenging and hugely impactful on quality of life for these patients. Again, unfortunately, the only treatment is wheat avoidance. So really sort of all of these things, the treatment is wheat avoidance. But for something like true wheat allergy, you know, with it being potentially life-threatening, you really have to strictly avoid it.
Wow. It's hard to believe there's so many nuances and just that the body responds the way it does just to wheat, something that you just think of as a simple thing that's in food.
Yeah. It's just a grain. It's just out there growing.
And it looks so innocent out in the field.
Blowing in the fields, amber waves of grain. It's hard because, especially for certain types of wheat intolerance, people can maybe tolerate unbleached wheat, or they swear they can eat wheat in different countries. So maybe it's something with the manufacturing or treatment of our wheat. We really just don't know, which can be so frustrating. But thankfully for these patients and their families, there are a lot of wheat alternative options now that simply weren't around even 5 years ago, but certainly a decade ago. So, you know, kind of piggybacking on the trend of being gluten-free, you're able to find hopefully some really delicious wheat-free options.
Definitely, definitely. All right. And staying in the farm field here, soy is, I guess, another big one.
Yeah, soybean. So soybean is a fairly common allergen in the United States, although probably a lot of the time overdiagnosed. So true anaphylaxis to soy is relatively rare compared to some of the other top nine, but absolutely can be present. Thankfully, is one that if you do have, you tend to outgrow. You know, one important thing to point out, and you know, one of the major benefits I think of seeing a board certified allergist is many people are counseled to avoid anything labeled with soy, but most products are really over-labeled. There are a lot of my patients who have soy allergy who are able to consume soy lecithin and even soybean oil, which can be found in a number of processed foods. So thinking about like how can we restrict as little as possible safely, that can be really empowering to patients and families when we meet.
And it sounds like the way to figure that out, though, is to work with an allergist. This isn't something you just want to play around with at home to see if you can handle something.
It's really hard because there's so many options out there to test for things like food intolerances. But then what to do with that information? Who knows? And a food intolerance is very different from a food allergy. And because allergy is a safety concern, every patient and family deserves to connect with a board-certified allergist. You know, we're so lucky to work with so many awesome pediatricians and family practice doctors who are able to even order initial testing and things like that. But there are options for dietary expansion. There are some things you're likely to outgrow. How do we monitor for that? And also treatment options that your general provider won't be able to give you. So every patient family deserves an allergist.
Now, a few years ago, we would have been able to stop this discussion right there because it was just the big eight. But they added somebody. So now it's the big nine with sesame being the kind of newcomer to the group. So
yeah,
how did that end up getting in the group?
Yeah, so sesame seed allergy is an emerging concern, particularly in the United States, and as of January is a required allergen label per the FDA. So sesame is most commonly encountered in foods like hummus and tahini, but many families, you know, are familiar with sesame seed buns. Those, you know, were available when I was young. But we think with a shift for more dietary exposures, you know, I wasn't eating hummus when I was two, and my two-year-old loves hummus. So, you know, exposures, and we know the allergy in general is increasing. We've seen a lot more sesame allergy. I personally see a lot more sesame allergy than I do of a lot of that top nine list. So sesame seeds and sesame seed oil and ground sesame and sesame proteins can be in a lot of foods. So it was great that they added it to the label. But unfortunately, because so many manufacturers and companies have struggled with supply chains, they weren't willing to make sure that all of their supply lines were free of sesame when the label came out. So it's actually been intentionally added by a lot of companies with the labeling law changes. So that's something that our families who are managing sesame allergy have had to navigate, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's never easy as you navigate all of these ingredient lists of what you can and can't eat. So every trip to the grocery store it involves a lot of reading.
Yeah, every label, every time. You know, there's brands of bread that families, that was their go-to if they had sesame allergy, and then they had to pivot. So definitely has presented a challenge, and I'm always in awe of our patients and families who navigate this and there every single day, just like you and your family do, John.
Well, thank you. We've gone through the big nine, which, as anyone listening, you can understand that it involves so much food that we all eat, and that is just common in our kitchens. Which I guess leads us to the biggest question: is how can we all help people with food allergies stay safe and feel more comfortable if they're kind of at your house or at an event that you're hosting?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The first thing I think is always to just be receptive to hearing about people's dietary restrictions and preferences, and making sure that you have food prepared in a way that your guest is comfortable with. And if they're not comfortable, asking, you know, how can we make this so you're comfortable? And in the end, knowing that it's not about you if they elect to bring some of their own food or not eat something that you've prepared because it's not safe for them or they don't feel safe. And, you know, many of our families with food allergy have experienced a situation where they got sick at a party and it, you know, resulted in an emergency situation. Maybe they just don't want to have to navigate that at your house. So just hearing people, you know, it's really unfortunate that despite the increasing awareness, I still have a lot of families tell me that there are family members who don't take their child's food allergies seriously, and they don't feel safe having their child eat there, which is really sad. You know, food allergy can be so isolating. When you're with family and friends, I don't think anyone wants to make their guests feel that way at all. So the biggest thing is to ask the patient or the parent, how can we make this safe for you? Because that answer is different for everybody with dietary restrictions.
I think a key to that too would be to keep ingredient labels around. If you are preparing something, don't just throw those out. Keep them for somebody to look at just to make sure that it might be safe.
Yeah, the new trend of like putting all your snacks in beautiful clear containers in your pantry is aesthetically pleasing, but perhaps really dangerous for patients and families with food allergy. So cutting out those labels and taping them to the bottom or back of those containers so anyone who might want to enjoy that food can make sure that it's safe.
Okay. Any other tips you might have just to kind of work with people that have food allergies or to try to make them feel more comfortable or just to make a safer environment?
Yeah, that's a really important question, but covers so many different things. I think at the end of the day, the most important thing is that patients and families just really feel empowered. So keep going to different doctors, different allergists until you find someone who can provide you with resources that you can turn to when these questions come up. How do I advocate for myself when I go out to a restaurant? How do I plan for travel to a country where they don't speak my language? You know, there's lots of considerations with layers of complexity, and there are resources out there. And as a medical community, we don't always do the best job of giving families those resources so that they're empowered to, you know, keep themselves and their families safe, you know, while they live their lives. But the expectation is that children and adults with food allergy live full, healthy, happy lives. So you need to connect with a doctor who helps you do that.
Those are fabulous words of wisdom, Dr. Bajelic. So
thanks.
Before we say goodbye, anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that this has been such a great overview of some common allergens. And just because your allergen isn't on this list doesn't mean that it's not a real allergy. You can be allergic to anything with a protein, or that's what I tell my patients. But, you know, managing one or many food allergies, as especially many of our kids do, all the concepts are the same, and you are not alone. There are others out there on this journey with you. And if you don't know anyone personally in their lives, you know, many of the patients and families that we serve in the Food Allergy Center have found really powerful connections in the community, or even leveraging the internet to just try and, you know, share experiences and learn best practices for people who are going through what you're going through.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. As somebody with a child with a food allergy, I can't even begin to tell you how much it means.
Thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege.
Odds are someone in your life has an allergy to one or more of the foods that we discussed today. With more understanding of the condition and a little caution in the kitchen, you can play a part in keeping them safe. Till next time, be well.
Thank you for listening to Health Essentials, brought to you by Cleveland Clinic and Cleveland Clinic Children's. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit clevelandclinic.org/HEpodcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to replace the advice of your own physician.